The term of office for the current board is it's a bit dark where you sit. Don't just want to move to the other chair. Yes. So we are going to 143 that we shortlisted to 37. Now we're trying to get to 12. If you could just talk to your CV, madam, and in the same breath tell us or tell or convince the collectors to just ensure that you are or to take you to be amongst the 12. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you very much to the committee for considering me. I'm honored to be here, and I thank you for the invitation. Chair, as I think it's in my CV, I've been a journalist since 1982. I started at the Argus, and I was their labor reporter covering then the mainly emergent black independent trade union movement, and then later on a political reporter recovering the resistance movement principally in the Western Cape, although I did some work in the Eastern Cape as well. And covering issues such as influx control and so on, Crossroads and KTC and the subsequent violence there. I think that what that period did for me was to consolidate in me a sense of how important the integrity of journalism was. Many of the members here will remember that there were times when, particularly during the states of emergency, when the newspapers showed, in my view, a lack of integrity and boldness in covering certain issues. And it struck me then that if you don't show some integrity in journalism, it really fails in its role, which is to serve society as a whole, over and above particular sectoral interests. I think that there were some successes in those days, but I also think that there were things which failures of our duty towards informing the public because of a fear of the government of the day. I won a scholarship to the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia in 1987. I graduated from there in 1988 and won the Henry N. Taylor Award for the Best International Student, together with my classmate, Yele Olajede, another African journalist from Nigeria, who later became one of the first African journalists to win the Pulitzer Prize. I think that was 2 years ago for his work on, his sort of very searing work on the aftermath of the genocide in Rwanda. When I came back to South Africa in 1989, I also paid the bills there in New York. They paid my tuition fees, but I paid the bills by working part-time in a very lowly position for the American Committee on Africa and had the privilege then of sharing an office with our current ambassador to the UN. I came back here in 89 and worked for a number of magazines covering the Defiance campaign and later the transition in the 90s, and was then deputy editor of leadership. And then in late 1994, I began my first relationship with the SABC as a political editor and worked here in Parliament shaping the first multilingual and representative political team for Parliament. Before then, I'm sure the committee members would know that there was a lot of segmentation on radio, with different languages having their own radio stations, significant segmentation of news. And we began to try, and in both structure and content, to provide a news service that would allow, as we said then and as we said later, to allow the whole country to hear the whole country. There were defining moments then, as there are defining moments now. The defining moments then were certainly the Truth Commission, the negotiation for the Constitution in 1996. I think that now we have defining moments on the horizon, such as the 2009 elections and the 2010 World Cup, which it becomes essential that the broadcaster be poised to play a role with professionalism. I went back to newspapers for a while and had a Nieman Fellowship at Harvard. I was deputy editor of the Sunday Independent and the Pretoria News, and then came back to the SABC. I was invited back as head of radio news in 2002. My job mainly was to, or my brief was to rebuild radio news, which was rather depleted from the days of bimedia. For instance, we, in some regions, we had no radio reporters at all. In others, the main languages of the region weren't covered. There were no Nguni-speaking radio reporters in Parliament at that time. And the news bulletins were often recycled from either TV or SAFA, and current affairs programs, by and large, did their own thing or used newspaper reporters to cover stories. I thought it was, at the time, a failure to deliver on the public broadcast mandate, which involves informing the citizenry with solid news reports. So radio, which has the potential to unite the country through a common pool of news, was again becoming divided and segmented. So we set about rebuilding it, you know, trying to get, you know, our budget straight, trying to increase, to provide relevant and interesting news on the current affairs shows, which would increase audiences. I think that we were successful in that regard. In the last year that I was there, we increased the listenership on the current affairs shows on all the stations by about 1.5 million. We tried to measure the progress that we made objectively, such as complaints to the Broadcasting Complaints Commission that were upheld, service to our mandate in terms of languages, and drew up editorial strategies that prioritized coverage of rural areas, small towns, Parliament, economic policy, and science, things that I think had been neglected and still are in the mainstream media to a large extent, particularly coverage of rural areas, which we were poised to do. During the 2004 elections, we, which was also the 10th year of our democracy, we set up an editorial project to really try and cover what had changed in 10 years. And sent reporters out to every corner of the country to actually look at people's lives and to verify things which, in journalism, I call the meta-narrative, a kind of a sense that something is the truth, but nobody checks out whether it is the truth. So, for instance, there's lots of unemployment, there's lots of crime, there's no water, there's no... Is that true? And we actually went and checked it out, because I think a lot of those meta-narratives are false, and that you need to... You need to investigate every single case to establish the truth. I mean, and to get away from the cliches. We produced, I think, 90 stories altogether for that. A number of them won awards, and we tried to give every political party as well a platform on the radio news platform so that they could put their points of view. And I think afterwards, we were complimented by ICASA, the HSRC, and the Media Monitoring Project about the election coverage. I think two things I'd just like to draw the committee's attention to that I think were important that we did was, one was that we began broadcasting news and current affairs in our 12th and 13th language, Ku and Kwe, which are the indigenous sign languages from people who were resettled in the Northern Cape. It was actually a very difficult process because the languages are mutually unintelligible. The only common language is Afrikaans. But we had a regional editor who kind of tramped the little streets between the tent town where people were living and found two matriculants. There weren't very many educated people at all, even with high school education, and trained them as journalists. And began to put on a daily, hour-long current affairs show in Ku and Kwe and 7 news bulletins a day. And I felt that it was really worthwhile when Mani Dipicho told us that he was the then premier, that in fact the pass rate in matric had gone up from zero three or four years before to about 50%, just simply because the general knowledge had improved because of a radio service. And we established a science desk with twice weekly science slots in 6 languages. We had help in this from the Department of Science and Technology, who sent our reporters to the American Academy for the Advancement of Science in Washington for specialized courses in radio reporting and science. In terms of the chair asked me to say what sort of value I could bring to the board, I think the first The first is in my experience in establishing common editorial values in radio. It's always a struggle to do that, but radio is vast. There, on news alone, there are about two, when I was there, there are about 250 bulletins a day and about 34 hours of current affairs a day. If you try and run it by sort of a diktat in an authoritarian way, you are going to fail because you cannot possibly monitor every single thing that goes out. What you have to establish is common editorial values and a common commitment to the Broadcasting Act and to the editorial code, which allows for, which I think calls for, I can't remember the exact words, but a high degree of professionalism in a news service and a diversity of voices. After I left the SABC, in 2005, I went on a fellowship to Wiser for 6 months and then was invited to Princeton University as a visiting professor. Part of the point of my fellowship at Wiser was to work on a book that I then began, a biography on the finance minister and the history of both the anti-apartheid movement in the Western Cape and the economic transition. I've almost completed it. It's due to be published next year by Penguin. But I hope that I have a grounded knowledge of the profession, both in terms of reporting, teaching, managing, and editing, both in print and the electronic media, and a knowledge of the history of our country and what led us to this point. I believe very strongly that good journalism can play a role in strengthening our democracy because informed citizens are empowered citizens. And I believe that fairness and accuracy are the sine qua nons of the profession. You have to start at that place, but also developing an understanding of the context and a creativeness in newsrooms that allows people to tell interesting stories that will grip listeners or viewers. I have a pretty wide knowledge of how the news and bulletins work on the radio stations and the important, sometimes delicate but crucial relationship between the news department and the radio stations, which is essential for getting the news out. And I think that the role of the board is probably one of oversight, and to some extent protection of management from unreasonable pressures, be they commercial or political. Both of those are often quite stringent. I think that the SABC, as is stated in the Charter in the Broadcasting Act, belongs to all South Africans, perhaps particularly the poorer and marginalized South Africans because of the reach of radio. I think that by the time, 72 years ago, I'm not sure of the current figures, but I'm about to say at least 18 million people listen to radio current affairs and bulletins. But we serve a heterogeneous and interlocking public, and for that reason we have to really bring to bear the best professional skills that we can. I think that it has a crucial role to play in nation building. One of the things which the SABC did during the elections, and I think has continued to do, is to hold what we call town hall meetings that are broadcast live on various stations. Our biggest, which was rather kind of difficult to manage, but it was a real tribute to people in the sense that they wanted to hear everyone with Sebo King, and the Lesedi broadcast we did, which we had 13 political parties participating. I didn't even know there were 13 political parties in Sebo King, but there they were and all had their say on radio. So it's essential, I think, to both nation building and also to creating a sense of an informed citizenry. I think that's all from my side, Chair. Thank you very much.
No, you're most welcome. I did not stop you deliberately because I could feel the passion that you have for the profession, but also in the process you are answering a lot of questions related to your CV. Members, let's see if there are any takers. Ms. Marx, Peterson, Ms. Voss, Ms. Sukuna.
Ms. King, you are unusually well placed to assist us with something. As we all know, there are allegations of bias against the public a broadcaster. And the only objective measurement that we've had in the recent past was the independent inquiry by Zulakis Institute and Gilbert Market into the allegation of blacklisting of commentators in particular. And I'm going to ask you in a minute to respond more widely than the issue of the commentators. They are both eminent gentlemen, and therefore their appointment was a very good idea. And they came back with a finding that no systematic bias in favor of one political party could be demonstrated against the head of News and Current Affairs, because the inquiry was about Dr. Zikalala. But they found rather that the way he ran news constituted arbitrary and unpredictable interventions, which resulted in the improper exclusion of some commentators. Interestingly, the one case in which there was clearly demonstrated a specific bias on a specific issue was the one in which you were involved, namely the instruction from Dr. Zikalala not to use certain people on the subject of Zimbabwe, being Mulesi Mbeki and the Archbishop Nkube and Trevor Nkube and Eleanor Sisuluk, and the fact that he personally excised the voices of the Archbishop and Trevor Nkube from certain TV broadcasts and made it clear that he would not tolerate their voices on any broadcast whatsoever. You wrote then a very stirring letter of objection in response, in which you said that it was neither morally, ethically, or professionally acceptable to you that the SAB should be run in this way. And the inquiry essentially accepted your version of it and made it clear that Zikalala didn't even try to differ from you or defend himself. On the contrary, his response to you at the time was as follows: I don't think that I will have the time and energy to be involved in such arguments. So now there's the one clear case we had of bias. I'd like you to ask you to assist us in, you left the SABC. Would it be appropriate to ask you to tell us exactly why you left? Other political editors and reporters have left, the person who proposed you, amongst others, Denzel Taylor. It would help us if you could give us a categorical view of the degree of political bias being enforced there, the degree of censorship being practiced, because for the rest, you see, we all have anecdotally the evidence of our eyes. I was too interested, for example, after the health minister story broke in the Sunday Times, to watch the Kosa News one night. And the cameras, I never saw such footage in my life, the cameras dwelt lovingly, there's no other word, on a very staged tableau in which the health minister sat, coiffed, made up, beautifully dressed, at her desk, with a secretary bending down to attend to her. And the same footage was shown twice in the same news bulletin. It was quite clearly a defense of Dr. Manto. And we remember that she once summoned Dr. Zikalala and his cameras to an international press conference she was holding. She made the audience wait until he came with the cameras. So is that a specific relationship? Is it symptomatic of a systematic relationship with the cabinet or the ruling party? Or is your better place than most other people to give us a view on this? And yet, if you feel that you wish to make a statement on why you left, and by extension, why you now wish to sit on the board, that could assist us.
Okay. Yeah, I answered one by one. Okay, let me first deal with the question of why I left. I had been offered a fellowship to write a book which had been on my back burner for 4 or 5 years, a biography which I hope will contribute to knowledge in the country, and I've been offered a visiting professorship at Princeton. I had hoped to be able to take a year's unpaid leave. To do that, it's something that's common in a lot of the major newspapers and electronic media, certainly abroad, the bigger ones, is that an editor can take a year's unpaid leave and come back. And that is what I asked for, and it was refused. So I had to take a decision about what to do and whether I should give up those opportunities and or not. I That was the main reason. On the question of bias, my concern when I wrote that letter, and that letter I should emphasize was a private letter to Dr. Zikalala. The fact that it was only got to the commission afterwards, it didn't go anywhere else at that time. I think I copied it to the acting CEO, Solly Mokwetle, at the time. It was not the first such letter I'd written. I'd written many, many letters. If I was concerned that there was a breach of the Broadcasting Act or a breach of the editorial code, in the position that I sat, I could not do otherwise but to say, I'm concerned that we are transgressing our public service broadcast mandate. That was my responsibility to do that. And that was why I did it. I thought in those instructions which were given to the entire editorial news conference were arguably a transgression of the Act, and I thought that I have to make some intervention, because the producers of the current affairs shows were extremely upset, because they actually didn't know what now they were allowed to do and what they weren't allowed to do in coverage of Zimbabwe. But there was no personal, animosity around that letter. As I say, it was one of several that I felt that I had been obliged to write. As for the deliberate bias, I must tell you that when I was there in the 3 years, I had only two calls from cabinet ministers, and both of them were quite legitimate points. I mean, one was a factual error on the bulletins, and the other was, I thought, a legitimate and arguable point about the running order of bulletins. Perhaps it's not altogether in order that they, but in fact, the story, it was soon after I got there, the story that the bulletins were running with was so trivial compared to some big thing that I can't even remember the incident. But in both cases, I think it's your job to engage with people. You know, if you're sitting in that position and people call you, you can't say, please don't interfere. Your job is to engage and to discuss, but to take your own decisions at the end of the day in terms of the editorial code. My concern is, in my experience, I don't think that government as a whole or cabinet as a whole interferes in the kind of editorial day-to-day running. But I do think that there are decisions that are made that are either second-guessing government, trying to please government without knowing what to do. That's the one thing. And the other thing is, I think that the Commission put its finger on it, is that they are the three decisions. And in fact, what worries me is that it's not good for government either, because if you have decisions, those decisions can sometimes disadvantage certain cabinet ministers, because certain cabinet ministers are not covered, I think, in my view, in terms of policy, as well as they should be covered as in relation to other cabinet ministers. Now, I go out possibly on my own here with this interpretation of events, but the famous, and it happened the month after I left, the famous booing event of the new deputy president, Ms. Mlambuluka, and there was a commission about that, and they blamed the cameraman. My view is somewhat different. My view is that it was a failure of news judgment not to send a TV reporter to cover a new deputy president in what they knew was a volatile area in Northern Natal. And I have to ask myself, why that decision was made not to cover her. So the only person, the only TV person, there was a radio reporter there. I breathe a sigh of relief that there's some, kind of professionalism still there that they went. But the only TV person that was there was a freelance cameraman who really can't be expected to make the kind of decisions that suddenly fell on him in a huge way. Those kind of stories are not surprises. You know that they're coming up, and you sit at an editorial line conference and you say, what are your major stories for the day? And you see that the new deputy president is going to be in Northern KwaZulu-Natal. My judgment would have been to send a really competent TV reporter there. Because I don't know how, I still don't know to this day how many people, was it really a booing incident? Was it just a little flurry in the tent? I don't actually know what she said. We deprived the public, in a sense, of what she actually said at that meeting through not sending a TV reporter. So So my view on the bias is that it's complicated, but it's not as simple as government just dictating the terms. I think that many people in government actually are the victims of arbitrary decisions as much as the beneficiaries.
What we have heard, Ms. Green, in the previous interviews is that actually commercial interference is much more than political interference. What would be your take on that?
I think that there, Chair, a number of commercial pressures, that certainly one of the issues that came up when I was there was should the presenters, the news presenters on current affairs programs be used to voice adverts like they do on the commercial shows. My personal view is that it's really wrong, that you shouldn't use news presenters who rely on their credibility. I think credibility is absolutely everything in this business, to voice adverts. It was an ongoing discussion, and I made myself unpopular by holding fast on that one. I think the fact that the SABC gets a lot of, most of its revenue from advertising is an inbuilt sort of structural problem that is going to give rise to some kind of commercial pressures, if only for the revenue. And the third issue is, and this is really, I suppose, in the purview of the committee rather than the purview of the SABC, is to what extent current business interests, both within management or within, if they are in management, you are supposed to declare them both for the board and management, but to what extent business interests put commercial pressure on the broadcaster, given the increasingly competitive nature of the game at the moment and the increasingly competitive nature of TV. So I would agree, I'm not sure how I would weight them, I would agree that they are as potential a threat as political pressure. And it's important to have a kind of a distance from those interests to protect the broadcaster in to be able to fulfill its mandate.
Thank you very much, Mr. Peterson.
Stephenson, thank you. Good old days, people always wanted to emulate Papa Green. Journalists, the print electronic, Papa Green has always been associated with good journalism. And I kind of feel uncomfortable to ask the question, but I'm still going to do it. I think he's trained and matured enough to be able to handle it properly, these two kind of questions. The one is, you know, there's always consistently people raise the question about the Eurocentric view vis-a-vis an African view or African view, and that's all of that. If you sit back and where is it Africa is today, I have an idea of what Eurocentric view is. But in terms of developments in Africa, where you find a strong thrust of black people coming through to the middle class, living in Bishop's Court, driving compressors like me, you know, all of the good things that we were once associated with good European standard of living, and just all of that. How would you describe that African view vis-a-vis Eurocentric view? Because it seems starting to get blurred. There might be still a dominant African view from those lower down, but as, like I said, as you progress up, starts to get blurred, and yet we hold on to that. That's the first question, Jefferson. The second one is about the funding model. There's a continuous debate from us that says advertisers contribute 80% and thus somehow through pressure on all kinds of kind of give direction to SABC, to the broadcaster. My party asked for a fully funded public broadcaster, so the state, the treasury, must fully fund SABC. Now, I accept and understand if advertisers would pay everything but for the 2% the state is paying, that they will have a huge influence in the direction of the broadcaster. Isn't the same true that if the state should fully fund, that it could end up in inverted commas or tongue in the cheek, that you would have a state broadcaster? where the state will say, I'm paying everything, including advertising, and that all of that, that you could end up not a strong public broadcaster, but a very strong state broadcaster. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Over to you, Madam.
Thank you very much for the question, Honourable Member, and thank you for your kind views about me. I'm not sure if they deserve, but let me say on the question of the Eurocentric South African, I suppose, dichotomy, is that I think what surprises me in this country is that we don't compare ourselves enough with the world. We don't see ourselves enough in history. The course I taught at Princeton was called The Role of the Media in Emerging Democracies. And there are extraordinary parallels between in various post-revolutionary societies, including the United States after the revolution, and the kind of debate, the vituperative debate that went on around the media there. I mean, it took them something like 100 or more years to scrap what they called their Seditious Speech Act. The people went to jail in 1914 for putting out pamphlets against conscription and against the First World War and for socialism. And all they had done was put out pamphlets. So those debates exist in a lot of societies. And I think that when we've been really fortunate in this country because there was such a quality of intellectual input in the days of political struggle that we established such high bars for the kind of freedoms that we have now, that we were fortunate not to do that. So I think that what the issue is not South Africanism versus Eurocentricism, but an ability to see ourselves as part of the world, part of Africa, first of all, and part of the world. We are unique, yes, but we're also not that unique in that we are a rapidly changing and transitional society, and we need to look at others, you know, such as America 250 years ago, or Brazil, 20 years ago, the kind of economic policies that were applied in, say, Argentina or Chile, and what happened and what the results were. And I think then we'd feel kind of more comfortable about ourselves in a way. I'd like to see more of that reporting done in the media. On the funding model, it's a difficult thing because the SABC does have, to a large degree, a monopoly. At least they have the lion's share of the airwave frequencies, which gives them opportunities to raise advertising. I do think that there is a skewing in the direction of advertising which makes me uncomfortable. I'm not quite sure whether we as a country could afford to fully fund a broadcaster, and as you say, then you have the uncomfortable feeling that it should become a state broadcaster. But I do think that there should be a better mix of funding, and I do think that certainly the parts of the operation that are commercially struggle. Like, you're not going to get advertising. For instance, when I spoke about the station we started, or XKFM, the Coup and Quest station, it's very difficult to get advertising for that, but it's also a very important service. So perhaps some of those more worthy public service aspects that the broadcaster provides should be better funded by the state. But I would be uncomfortable with 100%. Also, knowing the priorities in this country, can we afford to do that? But I think that advertising has too large a share.
Ms. Green, I've heard your concern. Let me turn it around a bit. You find the judiciary fully funded, and yet you find them on a regular basis, on a continuous basis, for all the right reasons, they wouldn't even rule against the state. So is that concern that a fully funded or better funded, currently it's about 2% coming from the second, 70% from license, and 80% whatever. But a better one, even fully funded one, is that concern really justified? Like I said, if you look at many of the rulings coming out on a regular basis against the state, they're funded.
It's certainly an interesting point. I think that the difference is that the judiciary by, perhaps it's because, and it's a problem with journalism, you know, in the country and probably the world over, is the degree of professionalism is different. If it were fully funded, I would expect that there would be a lot more accountability for how money is spent and for the value of the return of investment. So if you, I don't want to be a bean counter about this because accountants have sometimes said to, you know, as in my role as editor, but how many stories does each reporter do a week? And you can't judge completely by that because they could do one brilliant story or they could do 10 mediocre run-of-the-mill stories. But there is a point to be made about, and it's perhaps in the purview of this committee as well as the board, to look at the amount of money that's invested and spent and the return on that money. I would think that there would have to be much tighter accountability if it was funded from completely from taxpayers' money. That said, I think as well to protect the credibility of the broadcaster and to make sure that it delivers on its mandate, you're going to have much higher and more internationally competitive professional standards. I think there's unevenness in the standards. I think there's some very good patches of the SABC. I also think that there's some parts that are where the professionalism is lacking. And one would have to do that to get people secure in the knowledge that this is their broadcaster, it's not the government's broadcaster. It really has to be a public broadcaster.
Thank you, Ms. Wong. Just for a second, can I take Ms. Nkukuna because she's about to be. Ms. Nkukuna.
Thank you, Professor Akenta. I am moving from yourself, maybe having to have an uncomfortable feeling about an issue. If you have such a feeling, let's say you were to be nominated to serve on the board, and there are these feelings will come, are you going to be able to raise this feeling sharply to your colleagues to say, here I am not comfortable, I would propose that we do it like this? And then secondly, it still rallies around the very same question that I ask. In your life as a journalist, have you ever been in a situation where you found that you had this particular story, maybe after your editorial meetings and so on, that story could not be published? Have you ever been in such a situation? So by responding to this question, maybe you will be telling us about the freedom of expression, you know, the right to dignity and so on in your response. Thank you.
Thank you.
What
do you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me answer the last part first. I think I'm curious about that, Honourable Member. Yes, there's certainly stories that one hears about that one has to think carefully about whether you run them or publish them. Because with freedom of expression, if you're in this profession, comes a high degree of responsibility. Now, in my own career, I'll give you an example. You might remember some years ago, probably about 10 years ago now, there was a story that went around, excuse me, about, what was his position now, that it was about Advocate Nsebeza on the Truth Commission, and the fact, I think that he was the head of research in the Truth Commission then, or that certainly a prominent member in a getaway car that had been his, and that was during the hearings of that PAC group that had attacked the Heidelberg Tavern. I don't know if you recall that case, and that was being heard in the Truth Commission. The story went round like wildfire. It was published in a number of newspapers. I had a really uncomfortable feeling about it. And sometimes you have to use your instincts. I just didn't believe it. I did not believe the story. So I tried to persuade my own newspaper to hold off on it until we'd done some more investigation, which we did. And in fact, after we'd published our story, we found out that the guy who'd accused him, he was supposed to be a gardener, had a house in Kenilworth, R200,000 in the bank. It just didn't add up. And in fact, this chap confessed afterwards to Archbishop Tutu that he had been paid and set up to finger advocate and Cereza. I think that responsibility is incumbent on every single editor. Another example I heard, and I think it's just a question of experience. I'm not blaming anyone because these things can happen, but what is published and what is broadcast has extraordinary effects on people. I heard maybe about 9 months ago the story on the radio bulletins about a blast in Sasol and in Mpumalanga. Now, you can imagine there's been 2 blasts before, I think, in the last 3 or 4 years, and it settled a whole panic amongst workers and their families for obvious reasons. The only problem was it didn't happen. It didn't happen, and I mean, that is a case where editorial responsibility has to be brought to bear on checking out the story and trying to check out a second source. You do not tell stories that come from one source and that come without being checked out. So I would answer, in terms of freedom, your question on freedom of expression is that it comes with a high degree of responsibility to check out, A, its relevance to the public, and B, its truth. And I think that the truth is really critical in these cases, because you can do a lot of damage if you don't publish the truth. On your first question about, and I'm not sure, would you please correct me if I understood it wrong, about basically raising feelings with colleagues, I don't think I've never been shy to do that. I mean, it's maybe one of the things that irritates other people about me, but if I think that something's wrong, I try and deal with it in a way that's going to try and be constructive and take it forward. I will talk to the person, I will write, something is necessary, but the SABC gives you good experience for that, actually, because when I went in radio news was completely inferior and second class to TV news, and one really had to argue the point about why it was important to rebuild this. In arguing that point, you often step on several important toes. So it becomes, but you learn how, it's part of living in our country. You learn how to engage with people and to take their views on board, but to try and say what you think is right.
Just one thing that, for clarification, here you are a member of the board of the SABC. Clearly, the editors do not want to be interfered with. There's something that you don't like that they are doing. How would you approach that lest you be accused of micromanaging the staff?
Thank you, Chair. I think that's a very important point, because I think it's crucial that the board doesn't micromanage. The board is there to set policies and to basically ensure that the right standards of professionalism apply. If those policies are being abrogated, I would think that it's up to the members of the board to raise it at the board with the GCEO and the relevant people in management. But you certainly don't go and micromanage. You certainly don't go into newsrooms and kind of speak to reporters, even, that kind of thing. I think that it's a totally erroneous view of what a board should do. But you are there to safeguard policies and to safeguard the public broadcast mandate.
Well, thank you very much. You must think it through very carefully. I'm taking you, madam. Because as a non-board member, as a journalist, you have the right to intervene anywhere and to publicly say things that you don't agree with. As a board member, I don't know whether you would be still have that latitude, but I'm just saying, think it through. So on. Not something that I'm feeling uncomfortable about. I'm just saying, like I said to Ms. Mushala, who was here to say she's got a lot of time, no family, no other things to say. She was also thinking through, because we don't want to continue to deprive her that right to look after her family. It's not a question. It's just something that you must bear in mind. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson, Ms. Green. In fact, I was going to ask that question, but in a different way, but I'll get to it. If I may start off, in your resume, in the heady days of post-94, you became political editor, as you've explained to us, of Radio News. And then, and that was from from 95 to 97, and you, as explained, were part of a management team trying to transform the previous government's mouthpiece into being a journalistically trustworthy public broadcaster. And then again, in from 2002 to 2005, had, as we've heard of, the SABC Radio News. I'd be interested, just as an aside, to hear, in those two periods, did you see from the early days when you had a huge task to turn the then state broadcaster into an emerging public broadcaster, and then doing that work as much as you could, and then going on to 2002-2005, whether you thought things had got better, whether you, just the culture, and give us some idea of your impressions then, because clearly something's gone wrong. I mean, there's no doubt about that on a whole range of issues. When I was doing my research for these interviews, I came across, you were quoted now, but you have to tell me what was correct or not, but you were quoted in a publication as saying, quote, at times in the post-apartheid era, and then there was a, that was in quotes, and then it said SABC had become, and then it was quoted again, the political grazing ground of the ruling party faithful, unquote. So, going first of all, I don't know whether it was because it was quoted in a broader article, but quoting you as having said that. So, following on from that, we have a situation where, in today's business day, you have sources in the SABC saying that employee dissatisfaction is rife. Those working at the public broadcaster say that self-censorship levels are now so high that it's trickled down to the point that writers know what they can and cannot say. There are certain stories a writer is too afraid to write. Allegedly, tapes that are going missing, that Dr. Sukhi Zikalala is reigning supreme, and people are now self-censored, their self-censorship is rife. So with all of this happening, with paper after paper, saying, for instance, that the SABC board and the corporation's management are loaded with party hacks, ideologues, deplored cadres who, in their rush to sing their master's praises, have undermined the corporation's editorial integrity and allowed censorship, manipulation, and propaganda to become a stock in trade, and so on and so forth. How would you, if you were appointed to the board, with the kind of background that the chairperson has raised, having worked within the editorial department, how would you see if you could play a role in assisting to turn whether they're realities or whether they're perceptions? The fact that these things are happening, the fact that you've got huge reports on blacklisting and so forth having to be commissioned, and then major problems even surrounding the fact that they're leaked or not leaked or so on and so forth. Where would you start approaching this? In a collective, of course. But what would you, at the first board meeting, should you be on the new board, how would you introduce this, if at all?
Chair, could I ask Ms. Fosh, what is the fact from the tapes said to be missing and not available therefore for broadcast are said to be those of Dr. Monta, not that?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I told you earlier about the Pulsar News. Unbelievable.
But they didn't always throw the files. They also throw the tape on Dr. Monta. Why did you say that?
No. Let's
do this then. Let's allow the questions to be responded to, and then come back to our own commercial. Oh, nice, madam. I know what you're talking about. It's just that I'm trying to just focus on the issues that were raised by this first before we answer. Ms. Green, please.
Thank you, honourable members, for the questions. I should say that when I was at the SABC, you know, kind of within management, when I raised things that I thought might be wrong or might be right, or I did it within the structures of the SABC. I didn't go outside at all because I thought it would be unproductive to do it that way. It's not productive to want to shout from the rooftops when you can change something by making your point internally. That's how I tend to operate within organizations and you know, wherever I am. On the quote that is quoted, I think it might have been from The Economist. It's slightly out of context. I don't want to call a reporter out of context, but what I had said, I had written an article, the Nieman Foundation magazine did a special issue on courage of journalism, and I actually mentioned some of the SABC regional editors in the provinces who have a lot to deal with, a huge amount of stress and to deal with. We had one reporter in Kwakwa who was actually murdered covering the Harry Smith unrest. I mean, he went on an interview and he never came back. His body was found in a shallow dam, and the police have still not arrested the people responsible. Now, there are a lot of issues and political pressures that regional editors have to contend with, and one of those is regional managers who like to obviously make things, relationships as smooth as possible. What I had said in that whole sentence was I've said that the SABC is a complex animal. At times it has professional excellence, at times it's political grazing, whatever that phrase was, at times it's incompetent, at times it excels, and sometimes all at the same time. And that's completely true. You have pockets of excellence that will persist no matter what. You have a kind of opportunism that also sometimes rises in a way that's unprofessional. So it's very complex. You cannot understand the SABC in simple terms. On the question of culture, and I think particularly the culture of change, I think it's an interesting question because I know this word is very popular these days, this word transformation. And we have to really look at what that means. I think that to a significant extent, but not to 100% extent, because as I said, I still think that they're excellent corners of SABC and in journalism as well. But to some extent, the culture has not changed that much since the apartheid days. And it's not a question of racial transformation. It's a question of cultural transformation. A lot of the middle management, both black and white, are often inherited from the apartheid days. So you'll find a guy in a very powerful position now, who may well be black, who used to be an announcer on Radio Transkei or Radio in the Bailey radio station or whatever, and they have their own memories, some of them horrific memories of how they were ordered to report news. I had, you know, I had one colleague who told me that he went to interview, I think, the chief minister of what was called Juan de Bailey in those days, and he was asked what questions should he ask, and they said, don't bother to ask questions, just put on your tape and let it run. And then when he came back, he said, how should I edit this? They said, don't bother to edit this, just play it out on air. Now that's the kind of culture that sometimes still persists because you've got a lot of the same people. You know, people who were calling Nelson Mandela a terrorist are still in those kind of positions. I'm not blaming the people at all. But what one needs to do to engender an environment of debate that will allow for some creativity and a professional standard in some areas, not in all areas. Some areas are very good. I'm not sure if I've answered all the self-censorship. You know, I think that has been something which has gone up and down at the SABC, but certainly there during the apartheid days, the Truth Commission records into the transcripts will show, into the media hearings will show you exactly what people in the SABC considered themselves to be. They considered themselves as having to be pro-government, even if they weren't. I think it's a pity if that culture hasn't changed, because what it does is it doesn't allow for enough debate to actually make the editorial judgments that need to be made, certainly in the news department, and probably the programming judgments that need to be made elsewhere. I have sat through debates, internal debates during the course of my reporting work in other government departments. And the best government departments, the debate is really robust. I mean, they look at every possible, you know, option, policy option, idea, or whatever that comes out, and then they can come out with a solid idea. It does not help excellence if debate within is in any sense suppressed.
If we're coming to the end, and I'm going to allow you a minute just to state your closing remarks, but over and above that, if somebody else outside of our borders wants you to give him a snapshot, the picture or profile of the Southgate Broadcasting Corporation, what would you say? Now, today.
I think I would say that it's a potentially excellent and helpful institution for people, but that it at the moment that there are a lot of lacunae where it's not working to its best potential. I do think that there's been, obviously, you know, after I've left and now I only know what I read in the newspapers, but I do think that there has been obviously problems of management there with particularly high-profile people. I think that public service broadcasting is has to be about public service. It cannot be about making money or political career or anything else. It has to be devoted to that. And the problems of management are now seem to overshadow what the good parts of the SABC are. And I think that's a real tragedy, because what happens then is its credibility goes down. And if there's one thing certainly in news, it's credibility. If people don't believe you as a matter of course, because you've made, even if you make a mistake in pronouncing somebody's name or spelling it if you're in print, they begin to doubt every other word that you say. So the degree of professionalism, I think, could be enhanced.
Your closing remarks, please.
I don't have much to say. I think that I've said it all. I'd just like to thank you again for hearing me and for having me here. As I said, I think that the key role of a broadcaster is to provide a credible and professional and interesting news service and entertainment service and information for the public. In order to do this, one really needs to have people of kind of high professional standing who are not afraid to cover the news in the best way possible, to be able to provide the service. There is nobody else in the country, nobody, that can reach the rural areas, the provinces that the SABC can reach. There is nobody else who can reach people in the languages of their choice. Now, if you don't put as much work into ensuring that you have really professional people on, say, the Steady Current Affairs shows or the Pada Pada Current Affairs shows, then you're not doing your job. My concern at the moment with the SABC is it's been too mired in kind of battles for things which are which should be outside of news and perhaps too political. It should perhaps get a little bit less political and a little bit more kind of devoted to public service and news. But it is probably one of our most important institutions and our most important institution for nation building and for creating a sense of unity in a country that is emerging as a democracy.
Madam, thank you very much and good luck. There is one very bright person that we were interviewing here who says the role of a member in a board like this is to have a slight but influential touch. I don't know what it means. I just heard that one. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Members, in the next half an hour, we're going to finish quickly with Ms. Nkonza. She's outside. She comes in. She's not a newcomer here. And let's just be directed to the question and then finish. No, let's just get it done. You may stretch if you want to.
Yeah.
from Sunday.
So she's no newcomer to this type of interviews, and she's the last one today, and she's hoping that we are tired today. I've just told her that some of us are elephants, we don't get tired, but obviously we have to go to the issues here. Like we did with, just to tell you, if you, in case you don't know, your chairperson of the board has withdrawn his candidacy from us. So we had 8 people from the board who were renominated. Now we there are 7 remaining. Yeah, 7. So I want you to talk to your CV, just to remind us about who you are, and what you're doing and what we need to know. And that also why you want us to consider reappointing you to the SABC board. If you can just take the platform and do that for us.
Thank you, Chair. We had an SABC board meeting yesterday, so the Chair did inform us about his decision to pull out of the running. So at least we are praised of that. Sorry?
Let's do that. The chair wrote a letter that says he was withdrawing a 2-liner, and the second line was that thanks for shortlisting him and so on. So I want us to leave it at that.
Okay.
So that if there are issues that were in the board, we'll just engage at the appropriate time. Lest Ms. Nkonza say things that she's not supposed to say. It's better if we ask the chair when we meet them in the board meeting, why did you withdraw? Ms. Nkonza?
Thank you, Chair, for protecting me. Just in terms of my background and the reasons why I think I should be considered at least for the next term of the SAPC board. Firstly, because out of my 4 years experience with the SAPC board, I do feel there's a need for more women on the board of the SAPC. Because SAPC is a very, and I'm not sure if I'm using politically correct words when I say it's very strongly masculine in its approach and in its applications of just things. So there's a need for more women. There is strength in having more women, just not only on the board of the SAPC, but also as part of the management team. I think there would be more value in having more women in the SAPC. Secondly, in terms of my skills, I think I'm one of a few who have worked both in community media and public media, and I think I bring a lot of value in the ability or the understanding of the public and community. So I have that experience of knowing what it is like to firstly to start community media from scratch, but also to bring that experience onto the SABC, which is strongly needed. If you look at the approach that we've taken over the last 4 years in the goals that we developed for the SABC, our focus was more in serving the public in the country. And I think that's a very useful skill. It has been a very useful skill within the SAPC. But also, I'm a very supportive person. I've been mostly in the background within the SAPC board, but I'm quite dependable. I'm very supportive. But I also pay attention to detail. I brought my experience of content understanding of content, and linking that to the Act. I was very strong in doing that, in driving the content provision, especially local content within the SAPC. And those are just a few of the reasons that I think I should be considered for the next SAPC board.
Before I take questions from members, I just want to dispose of 2 matters. One, you must just assist us here. We've got the candidacy of both yourself and Mr. Mtinde. the chairperson and the CEO of the MDDA, both of you wanting to go to the SABC. If you can just assist us there, you know, who to take or who not to take. And secondly, how would that affect your work at the MDDA? The other method that I want to dispose of, members, you'll recall that there's a matter that we wanted to take up with the board of the SABC, which was a financial matter on page 42 that was raised by Ms. Bulbulia. I followed up that matter. It's a non-threatening matter in my view. It was Mr. Chakera who was doing business with the SABC, the ex-husband of an executive. So I'll give you this. If you want to follow it up or want to do anything about it, that's your call. But when I read it, I said, it's nothing really to write home about. But that's my point. I'm giving it to you. Ms. Mkonza, please, you can just respond to the Lumkom Mkonza question.
I think in terms of who you decide to take between Lumka and myself, I think I leave it up to the committee to decide. But also on the MDDA, our term of office is coming to an end, end of this year, at least January next year. And it was not my intention to avail myself for the MDDA board. So I really don't think it's up to me. And the fact that Lumko availed himself for the SABC board is not a matter. It's an individual choice. It's not a matter that is up to the MDDA. So it was his decision to avail himself. He does have my support in availing himself. So I think it's up to the skills that are needed in the SABC board. It might be difficult if I'm still on the MDDA board and we both are involved. You know, it might pose some problems. Maybe I would not know. But I think it's a decision that must be taken by the committee. I have no specific views because my intention was not to avail myself for the MDDA board.
No, the MDDA board is ending at the end of the year. You have to appoint a new board. She doesn't want to go back to the MDDA. So, can I ask the question again, Lumko or yourself? You don't know.
It's up to you.
No, I'm just asking again. I just want to check another.
It's an unfair question.
That's fine. You know, I was listening with keen interest what the answer was previously. Okay. Any questions? I've got Mr. Kumalo, Ms. Foss, Mr. Peterson.
Thanks, Ms. Mkonza. The corporation has been going through thick and thin, attacks on over the side, also a lot of mistakes that have been taking place in the board. I'm not so sure what has been the racing in the board, whether it's yesterday's meeting or whether in the past, in terms of just dealing, what is the approach or strategy of how to get off this quagmire hodgepodge. You know? Secondly, you were focused at the board of much more on the public broadcasting service in terms of the area of speciality that you've been given. Now, in India, the funding models in India is quite much more license-free, depend much more on the commercial. You know, the Indian television must generate more income in terms of how it does things and compete. In New Zealand, the opposition to the private opposition in stations get more funding from the state, and the state does not give any to what is called the TVNZ, Television of New Zealand. So there is no public funding, and then they've also abolished the licensing fee. Actually, 9% of that is actually given to commercial, not to radio, community radio stations. And now in other countries, is that type of hybrid model where you've got public funding, commercial revenue, and then the licensing fee. What would be the exact type of good model that would assist the public broadcasting, in particular to achieve his mandate, and which of us also wanted to just explain the actual, that's in the mind, that is the actual mandate of the broadcaster. That's that. And thirdly, having been in the board and the board having gone through all these things that I have done to you, issue of the blacklisting, the audit report on Sicily, the PSL issues, and all the things that has been happening, what do you think should be the direction that SABC board should be in terms of just coming from an apartheid era into a new political settlement, now moving into completely new terrain of a developmental state? What should be? What sort of a vision that could guide, what kind of could guide the country in terms of what should be, what we are proud of as South Africans, like our South Africanness, what constitutes South Africanness in terms of what the vision of the board should be? Thank you.
Okay. In terms of the funding model of the SABC, I think as a transforming society ourselves, it is important that we have a broadcaster that creates a platform, frankly, that creates access for all of the different voices. And I think it's up to it's just that provision of the platform that is key, but also being able to say these are the issues that we're trying to address as a country. And for me, if we could identify those issues that we need to be discussing on the SABC platform, then there's no question, there's no doubt about the issue of accessibility, that SABC has the largest access to different populations in the country. So if, I think even at government level, if the issues that the SABC could be quantified and identified in the form of public value, to say this is the public value that SABC holds in terms of the public, and then focus on providing funding for those. I mean, I'm sure there's a certain time, maybe 20 years or 10 years down the line, we can say the SABC has done this. I think the difficulty at this point in time is that the SABC plays like any other broadcaster. It addresses issues like any other broadcaster. So if, for me, it's finding the public value. I do think that the funding model has to be continue being a hybrid. The issue of licensing is very tricky at this point in time because it depends on the ability to collect licenses. I think if it could be in some form of a text or something, so that there's more obligation to pay, but there needs to be an education or a campaign to say the value that you are paying for, just to individual members of the public, say the value that you're paying for is this. I think the difficulty is that some people do not find value in what they're paying for. This is the challenge that we have when we consult with the different members of the public, say, but I don't see the value of paying the license. So it's that thing, it's a matching of the value and what people need to pay for. But I do think there needs to be an obligatory system for people to pay the licensee. But I also think on the part of government needs to identify areas that they are willing to fund for. It is difficult when the SABC has to rely, it's almost 98% of commercial funding that the SABC depends on. But I think if I was sitting in Treasury, if SABC is able to raise 98% of its revenue from commercial funding, it would give me a difficulty to say, why should I fund? If you're able to raise the funds, why should I fund? But the thing is, if you do this, if we allow that situation to continue, if it's 100% commercially funded, for instance, then there will be no need, maybe SABC might, but there's no need for us to be obligated to provide this public service if we can raise funds anyway. So it's a matching, it's finding a balance between commercial funding and public funding, but it is also an obligation maybe on government to define the areas that government should be paying for in on behalf of the public. But I think the licensing issue needs to be addressed thoroughly in this country. At the moment, I think it contributes about 9% of SABC's, I could be wrong, I don't have the figure, but it's about 9% of SABC's revenue. And I think the collection methods, they are improving, but they're not, you know, you put so much effort and resources into trying to collect the funds, and you still don't collect 100%. And increasingly,
Therefore, the SAPC needs to put in resources into the collection method, and that makes it difficult, but you're still not collecting 100%, and it, you know, at some stage it might be a futile exercise. So I think that there's a need for to find, and there hasn't been an increase in the licensing fee over a number of years. That in itself, for government or for the committee to sit and decide that there should be an increase, is a difficult matter. So I think until such time that you find a satisfactory way of finding the public value of the SAPC, the issue of funding is going to continue being a contentious issue. But I do think it has to be addressed.
Thank you very much, Ms. Foss.
Thank you, Chairperson. A couple of questions. You mentioned earlier, it just might have been the way in which you were saying it, but my ears perked up when you said, I'm a background person on the board. So if you could just tell me, you know, what did you mean by this in particular? You clearly chair a committee, but in terms of your active role on the board, I mean, we've got, following on from Mr. Kamalo's question, you know, we had the Commission of Inquiry into blacklisting, and there are numerous other issues that obviously seized your attention, or hopefully did. So if you could just give me some idea of your views on do you think that the board has dealt appropriately? Do you think that it can now sign off on the issue of the blacklisting and related matters report? Do you think that is the end of the matter, you've dealt with it, and when the new board is constituted, it need not apply its mind to this at all? And I've asked this question, so it's only fair that I ask you. I've asked this question of other board members. Contained within this report, there was, on page 60, the report states the Commission was presented with considerable amount of documentary evidence emanating from the Seapoint SAPC News Office, etc., etc. We feel it important to state that there appear to be serious problems at the Seapoint office, which, if true, are concerned with issues of political partisanship, and so on and so forth. So, as a member of the board, could you tell me, to your knowledge, whether this matter has been dealt with, the huge amount of documentary evidence pointing to serious problems in the Seapoint office, and whether this has come to your attention, particularly dealing with the issue of allegations brought up by in the Commission of political partisanship. So dealing as you do with issues of public broadcasting, if you could tell me how you have dealt with this, if at all. Then could you, we had another nominee who described herself, apart from her obvious other credentials, as you have as well, as being, in addition to her academic and other background qualifications, being black, a woman, and being young. And this should be taken into consideration in also. Now, you are black, you're a woman, and you're practically about the same age as other candidates. So how have you and exercised those other qualities of being black, a woman, and being young, as being a member of the board? Have you inserted yourself or tried to insert yourself in issues dealing with youth? If not, who else has done it? If you could give me some idea of the kind of debate in the board around issues relating to youth. If you could give me some ideas about, if you haven't done it, who has, on issues relating to women, and particularly black women. And this doesn't necessarily mean black rural women. I'm talking about black women in their totality, because you have obviously have been on the board all this time, so I'd like just to get some insight into the debate in the board, as this is given as a criteria for selection by some people. I'd like to get some idea of your views on that being a criterion, and how one would take that forward in the board if it has, in your experience, been taken forward.
Okay, go ahead.
Again? Thank you. I'm not sure where to start on the issue of young black women. But just concretely, the issue of the youth is one of the areas where I do think we do not have a strategy, if I might call it a strategy, to say this is the youth policy that we have in the SABC until quite late. So we did not have anyone who was focusing on that, and that has been one of our weaknesses. It came up when we were meeting with the different political parties when that issue was raised, you know, what is the youth policy. But in terms of the different platforms, they have a focus. For instance, the SABC 1, its target audience is the youth, and their programming is directed to the youth. But as a board, we did not clearly set out a policy that says this is what we want to achieve in terms of the youth. So even though little things or little projects have been happening throughout the SABC, there was no, you know, particular policy or direction that came from the board to say this is how we want to address it. When I raised the issue on my strength as being a background person, it doesn't mean, I do not mean by that I'm not assertive. I am very assertive, but I pay attention to detail, and that's the strength that I have. When other people are all over, I'm very focused, I pay attention to detail, and I'm good at bringing issues that need monitoring, that need follow-up. That is the strength that I bring to the board. It doesn't by any means mean I do not assert myself. I'm not strong. I'm actually a very strong person. I know I look very quiet, but I'm very solid and strong and focused. So that maybe I did not clarify it, bring it out very clearly, but for me it is a strength. It's not always good if everyone is forward and trying to drive things. I do not operate like that. So that was, for me it is a strength, and that's what I was trying to bring out. But the issue of having women on the board, for me, I've seen it as a powerful tool, especially in the organization that we are in. The group of women that we had on the team, we worked very closely, we worked very well as a solid team in the board. And we saw that as a strength, also in encouraging other women throughout the organization. In management, we could sit and share the problems that we face or women face in the SABC. So in a way, we provided role models for other women in the organization, and I think that is quite a useful strength. So that's the part that I was trying to bring out in terms of women. The black part, I'm not sure. I am black, and I think so are many other people in this room. And it's not necessarily an issue. It was never an issue in the board that there's black and white. Those issues were not problems within the board. I think we operated quite effectively in unity as a board. The issue of color was not an issue at all. The blacklisting, I think by... There is no way, or there is not a time when we can say we've dealt with the issue, it's over. Because this particular commission brought out a whole lot of management problems that need to be addressed. Maybe the weakness in the board is in monitoring the implementation of those things. So you still have fine cases in Seapoint or in Polokwane or in other provinces where there are remnants of that process going on. So it's the monitoring maybe that should be done by the board through the news committee of how it's being implemented, of whether we're improving or not, and you know, whether we're improving or not will be seen in the quality of the news. So it's something that you constantly have to continue monitoring. And maybe one of the weaknesses that we have had as this board is not going back to the public often to report how far we are with the process. It's, you know, so it can never be over until we assure that all of the management problems that came out of that report are being addressed satisfactorily so, and that we go back to the public and say this is how far we've come, so that if there are still problems, we continue addressing them. So there is, from at this point in time, I don't think we can say it's done, it's closed, it's how we dealt with it, and it's over until we come back and continue monitoring.
So thank you. When I was told that you are black, young and so on, I'd like to look for your age, but I'm not going to ask you about the age.
No, I can't. That's why this is not.
numbers. The numbers between the previous one and the
previous. Oh, you've got an egg somewhere there. Oh, okay. I want to ask you about your age in public. Of course, here, Mr. Peterson.
Chipson, allow me to ask this question that I've asked to Ms. Green as well. Just to be not on the safe side, but just to see if one can get a consistent response to it. In fact, I'm going to put both. In terms of the fundamental that was raised earlier, the complaint that we don't get the right balance. Like I said earlier, my party would prefer a fully funded, faithful, territory funded broadcaster. Now, with that, people could raise the risk that a public broadcaster could become a state broadcaster. The second one, the chairperson, what I said earlier on my own, the debate in my own mind about this Eurocentric view has been very often being seen on television. How would you describe the difference, if at all, between a Eurocentric view and a South African view, given the movement up to the middle class, particularly from amongst blacks? Not just movement, some of them have been born, like, for instance, your Bishop Scott, all the time, drive nice cars, and to private schools, and just all of that. So, you know, if you take a black view, how would you describe if there is a difference between a Eurocentric view and a South African view? I can imagine people saying Western Cape or Cape Town and compare them with Europe. But what is the difference really? And if you take it from that angle, say, give me a South African or African view. If there is.
Yes, what do you want?
Thank you. I hope I'm getting the question correctly. For me, when I say the SABC needs to create that platform, it's exactly that interest. If there's no South African view, then the SABC needs to promote it. Not necessarily in defining that, but provide a platform for the public to define or, you know, promote the South African view. And I think the advantage in the Act is that we have the public broadcasting service, but we also have the commercial service. So we can play, SABC can actually play in both fields. But I think the difficulty is that at this point in time, the debates are probably not happening public enough, you know, to be able to influence young minds, to be able to influence broader society, and to also locate South Africa within the entire continent, the African continent, to say, let us be unique. If you go to other African countries, you find the uniqueness of people in those countries. If you meet a Nigerian, for instance, or a Kenyan, you can easily identify because they have that unique identity as a country. But I think in this country, possibly because of the diversity, for me, it's not being defined clearly enough, and I think the SABC needs to play that role to be able to define that uniqueness that we have as a country. I do think it's probably not happening public enough, but I think it's possible to define that South African view. And one of the discussions that we've had is, if you come into this country, if you go to any other country, you watch their television programs, you listen to their radio, you can feel the difference. But are we providing, you know, that uniqueness? When you come into this country, you switch on the television, do you feel that this is South Africa and this is what you see? You get the look and feel of being in South Africa. I don't think we're there yet. I think there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. I do not believe that it can be defined by the SABC alone, but the SABC can provide that platform. And maybe just through content, it needs to be driven harder. I don't think at this point in time we're there yet. And that's my individual view at this point in time.
Let me just respond to this question that says, should we fund the SABC 100% from the Treasury?
No, definitely not. I do not think it should be funded 100% because it is able to provide, to access the commercial market. I do not for one moment think it should be 100%. It could be, that's my view, but I don't think so. I think it is possible. I think what we are not doing satisfactorily, if what we would not be doing, is to leverage the commercial funds that exist. I think it is possible to leverage that, because the industry has a role to play as well in funding broadcasting in this country. It has a role to play in funding development or the transforming society. So I think if we do not access that commercial funds, we would be losing out on a resource that exists in the country. It's not my view that it should be 100%.
Just a follow-up on both questions. Given the influence, for instance, if you don't get the mix right, that commercial influence that could start to steer the SABC in a particular direction because of their muscle. That's the one follow-up question. The second one, given very often modernization are confused with westernization, we see that slowly reflected on even on a public broadcaster. This notion of that equals modernization with westernization. Just a comment on that as well.
On the modernization and westernization, I think we could get it right if we got the language mix correctly. I think at this point in time, there are some compromises in terms of language in the sense that it's not pure, and the culture is not what we've done. Part of the process that we've done in trying to address that is to set up panels, set up a language panel, set up a panel that addresses, that provides advice on culture issues and all of those things. I think if we strengthened those aspects, then we'd be able to find a balance between the South African view, if that's your question, and also, you know, continuing to be to modernize through technology, through language, and through the kinds of programs that we provide. I think it is possible to find a balance, and we have not focused on that as a key issue. We have provided a policy that looks at language advisory services and culture advisory services. So remember, a few months ago we had that problem with some of the programs that we heard on TV. I think there was a drama on circumcision. And for me, there's always a need for an advice that focuses for somebody who understands the culture. It's difficult for me, for instance, as a woman to talk about circumcision because I've never been circumcised. So I don't know what it's like. But if you get somebody who understands it, get different views for people who can provide that advice without necessarily putting it as wrong or as barbaric or something like that, because there are aspects, there are views in our society that say it is wrong to circumcise it. But if you bring on all of those views or that kind of background advice, I think we can get it right. I think slowly, if we focus on building those panels, then we can find a balance. I think at this point in time, we may not be, you know, fully balanced, but I think we can. I'm not sure if I addressed all your questions.
Can you also know that matters of circumcision and age are not declared publicly? I'm sorry,
no,
it's okay.
I agree. I mean, we've had those discussions. Should we even be talking about them?
Okay.
But at the same time, is how do we educate young people about our culture without talking about those things? I don't fully agree. Maybe it's the way we present them. If we present them and dramatize them and all of those things, then there's no balance. But I think it's a view that, you know, needs to be addressed.
No, I was just teasing you out on that one, because it's a debate that should continue. I think we must give you an opportunity, just a 1 minute, to say your closing remarks. I've checked here in terms of your board committees, board membership and attendance, and I'll leave it at that. It's not a matter that I think needs a lot of probing. But maybe your closing remarks before we wrap up the session.
I do have a few things that I want to raise, but I'll just focus on a few things. I think there needs to be more interaction between the committee and the board of the SABC. I think it becomes difficult if the committee only gets to know about things that are happening
only through the media, because the media will give you a particular view. So I do think I would advocate for, you know, more interaction between the board. Even roadshows, the roadshows that you had earlier on, but just for the committee to get more understanding about the difficulties, the challenges of being in the SABC board. I think it would be very useful that we do not interact only once a year or once in 4 years. I do accept that the committee is very busy. But I think that's the one key thing for me, that if there's more interaction, then we can, you know, get to share more views about how we're addressing. And I think it's important that we also get, you know, views about, you know, the work that you're doing at the SABC, well, currently and even for the future, but whether we're changing, we're making an impact or not. You know, if we're stuck in the same place for 4 years, then, you know, we need to know. I think that feedback is quite useful before issues become, you know, up for public consumption and they are in the media. I think it should be very useful to have more interaction and get more advice from the committee.
Thank you very much, and good luck. We will have some interaction with the board before the end of this year, meeting just to ensure that the matters of handover that you spoke about and other outstanding issues are taken on board. Good luck, madam. Members, we are having next week Tuesday. Next week Tuesday, we're meeting in the same room 1 year, and we starting with Mr. Trikamji, you call the list, Ms. Takula, Dr. Jinwala, Mr. Judin, Golding, Howard. We still try to confirm Bengo, and then we'll be close to finishing the following day, and to give you an opportunity on Thursday to consult with your parties, to debate, and to start. Obviously. Same, so.
Yeah.
Well, balance. Yeah. I was also hoping that we finalize the appointment, the election of the chair next week. The new chair.
What chair?
Your new chair. But Mr. Vati. No, we'll see it through, but so that he must not be sitting there, and he must start taking charge of this committee. Yeah.
In that note, Chairperson, and it would make sense for us, after we finish with the candidates,